And a happy 4th of July week to all of you from Bob Bupka and me, a rather raspy-voiced Kelly Elbin, here on Musings on Golf. And it's entirely appropriate that our episode this week highlights the upcoming American Century Championship and a terrific interview that Bob and I had with a great American entertainer, John O'Hurley, who you know as Jay Peterman from Seinfeld. We'll also recognize an unprecedented feat by a PGA of America club professional at the United States Senior Open. Bob, I know you celebrated a certain birthday last week, and this week all Americans celebrate our collective 248th birthday. Happy 4th of July week, my friend.
Hey, thank you, Kelly. It's always an honor to talk golf with you. And, you know, on July 4th weekend, I don't really celebrate the 4th of July as much as I pay respect to, you know, all the servicemen that dedicated their lives. When you watch some old footage, which I enjoy doing, of World War II and the invasion of Normandy, the sacrifices that were made by these men, young guys, 19, 20, 21 years old, just getting out of high school, having their whole life ahead of them, and then giving their whole life so that we have a great country, the greatest country in the world to live in.
I think there are all kinds of ways that people celebrate the 4th, and I certainly echo your thoughts. I think it's our greatest, it's our most important holiday. It's our most important American holiday, because without it, without the 4th of July and what happened on July 4th, 1776, Bob, I don't think you and I are around here today to talk golf and some of the other fun things we get to chat about. It's certainly a day of fun. I'm going to play some golf with some friends, with my girlfriend Susie and some buddies, and a little fun scramble at our club here in South Florida. I'm really, really have a big smile. My kids, my son Ryan, who lives down here, is flying out to see my daughter Megan, who lives in South Bend, Indiana, on the 4th. So they're going to be hanging out for 4 or 5 days, which will be a lot of fun. But it is really a celebration of everything that's great about this country, and Bob, the people who made it possible, right?
And what's great about the holiday? Just what you're being able to do. You're going to play golf. You know, I know you're going to enjoy every moment of it. And then your son going out to be with his sister. I mean, good golly. You know, throw in the hot dogs and hamburgers, and that's what 4th of July is all about.
It really is. Hey, you know what? There's a lot to enjoy from this episode of Musings on Golf. And Bob, I re-listened to the interview that we did with John O'Hurley. If we peel back the curtain a little bit, we mostly do these interviews in advance. We talked to John, gosh, it was a good 3 or 4 weeks ago, and in advance of the American Century Championship. He's played in just about all of them out in Tahoe. He's a really funny guy. He's a very talented guy. Your story about Alex Maselli at the outset of it is hilarious. John O'Hurley isn't just Jay Peterman. John O'Hurley isn't just the guy who's hosted the National Dog Show presented by Purina for years now on Thanksgiving Day. He is a versatile, versatile American performer.
Yeah, the longer you talk to John O'Hurley, the more you recognize the depth of his talent. He's very flexible, and certainly the American Century Championship means a lot to him. And you know, the championship means a lot to him, and he means a lot to that championship. I don't think they could get a better participant who enjoys it so much, who sets the tone for what transpires out there. Lake Tahoe, one of the most beautiful settings in the world for golf.
Now, you've been out there a time or two, haven't you?
I have been out there for this event, and it was pretty cool. Walking down the range, and there's Michael Jordan, you know. How you doing, Michael? Slicing it a little. Yeah, let me correct you. Then all of a sudden, said, who are you? And I said, Bob Bupka. He said, Bob Bupka is now helping me correct my slice on the range. I said, see you later, Michael.
That would be the only thing sports-wise that you would help Michael Jordan try to correct. Is that a fair statement?
That is a very fair statement.
Hey, recently, just in the last week or so, I've seen a new commercial from Budweiser that features Bob, our friend, PGA of America professional, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Rooney. Formerly, you know, not formerly, but Dan's flown several F-16 missions overseas. You talk about a great American, and Dan has been affiliated with Budweiser for many years now. He actually made a cold call to Anheuser-Busch when he started Folds of Honor and Patriot Golf Day. They said no. He kept at it and finally got them. They've been together for 14 years, and Anheuser-Busch, their wholesalers, and their brands have provided more than $28 million in funds for academic scholarships for the families of fallen or disabled military and first responders through Folds of Honor. And Folds of Honor, I'm not telling you all to buy Budweiser beer, but buy Budweiser beer around the 4th of July. They have some really cool patriotic cans, if nothing else, just to collect them. But Bob, and we've had Lieutenant Colonel Dan on our podcast before. Folds of Honor has now awarded more than 52,000 academic scholarships valued at more than $244 million to those spouses and children who I mentioned. If for no other reason, support a cause, a commercial entity that supports one of the great causes, in my opinion, in our country.
Yeah, certainly Budweiser deserves all the credit in the world, and Dan Rooney for pursuing Budweiser. I just think that that's a match made in heaven. I think Budweiser benefits, hugely with the partnership, and I think Folds of Honor certainly reaps the rewards of the affiliation they have with Budweiser.
Yeah, agreed. Bob, as we record this on Tuesday, the 2nd of July, I would think the vast majority of our listeners are aware that Frank Bensel Jr., PGA of America club professional, made back-to-back holes in one in the second round last Friday at the U.S. Senior Open at Newport Country Club. First time it's ever happened. The first time in the history, 1,001 USGA championships. First time there's ever been recorded consecutive holes in one in a USGA championship. And I got to thinking a little bit. He hit the same club. I think he hit a 6-iron on the fourth hole, 184 yards. And then with his caddy, his trusted caddy, and his son Hagen by his side carrying his bag, he then used the same club on the fifth hole from 203 yards out for his second ace, his 13th and 14th, by the way, in his career. He's a heck of a player. This is not Frank's first time to a major championship dance. But I got to looking up Cypress Point. The 15th is a short par three, and then the iconic 16th and Alistair McKenzie's classic design is one of the very few courses that we know of that has back-to-back par threes. And then Pacific Dunes, Tom Doak's just dramatic design out in Bandon, Oregon, is another one. The fact of the matter is there just really aren't very many back-to-back holes with par threes.
Yeah, you're so right. And, I can hear it already. When the rare opportunity presents itself, you're going to hear on the tee, why don't you pull a Bensel, Yeah. And I think, people will be striving for that for a long, long time. And most people will say, what the hell is a Bensel? Well, a Bensel's hole in one on two consecutive holes, first time in history, up there at Newport, and the limb is pretty thick that I'm going to go out on. I don't think we'll ever see that again in history.
Well, it's right. It took 1,001 USGA championships to get there. So I will not challenge you on that bet. We've got some great stories coming up. Really, really great stories from John O'Hurley. But before we get to that, congratulations to Cam Davis. It might have been a tough way to win a PGA Tour event at the Rocket Mortgage Classic with Akshay Bhatia, three putting really from gosh, I mean, what, 20 feet? It was highly unusual to see a PGA Tour player three putt from that distance. Nonetheless, it was Davis's second win on tour. His first came at Detroit Golf Club at the 2001 Rocket Mortgage Classic. So it had been 3 years. I think there had been a lot of questions in his mind. He even decided to go to hypnotherapy, as you're going to hear in these couple of cuts from Cam.
It was a roller coaster of emotions at the end there. Honestly, I felt like I'd done a pretty good job of really not knowing where I stood on the leaderboard. So I was honestly very surprised that I was tied for the lead with the last group coming down 18. And then realizing that the huge burden of trying to win again is off the shoulders. I'm working with a hypnotherapist. Sticking with the work that I'm doing was made a very big impact very quickly. I felt a lot better last week, even though the score didn't show it. And then to have it turn into this week is, it's hard to believe, really, because I was not in a good place 2 or 3 weeks ago. I guess I just missed the boat on the Olympics. This win's come a little bit late for that big goal for the year, but yeah, I've got two more big goals of finishing high up in the FedEx Cup and also trying to get in that President's Cup team. So, I mean, just to know that the good golf is in there and it's was able to come out this week, I want to just keep that rolling.
Sure. And again, as we lead into John O'Hurley, I was just really intrigued by him because, quite honestly, you know, I knew of him a little bit with Dancing with the Stars, as he'll talk about. Obviously, everybody knows him from Seinfeld as the rather enigmatic Jay Peterman. But the stories of John O'Hurley are varied and really quite impressive. He is a extremely talented man.
No doubt about that. I mean, you know, the more you talk to John O'Hurley, the more you recognize talent he has, along with tremendous versatility. I mean, he's absolutely incredible as an entertainer. And we certainly were very proud to have him participate on Musings on Golf.
And we're very proud of the partners who have chosen to be supporters of Musings on Golf. And right after you hear from them, you'll hear the interview that Bob and I did with the one and only John O'Hurley. Like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Celebrating its 30th year, the South Florida PGA Golf Pass offers the ultimate summer golf experience with special access to more than 100 private, semi-private, and public golf facilities. From May 1st through October 31st, Golf Pass members can enjoy special low rates, exclusive member-only outings, special offers, and more. For just $60, you can purchase the South Florida PGA Golf Pass and instantly gain access to all these great benefits through the member-only app. It's simple. Pay, download, play. Visit sfpgagolf.com/golfpass for more information. That's sfpgagolf.com/golfpass. Bob, fans of the iconic show Seinfeld and of NBC's wonderful National Dog Show presented by Purina every Thanksgiving Day, know our guest all too well. And the many fans of the American Century Championship will once again see his golf game on full display July 12th through 14 on NBC Sports, Golf Channel, and Peacock from beautiful Edgewood, Tahoe South. So much to cover with the great John O'Hurley here on Musings on Golf. Mr. Peterman, how are you?
Well, I'm the seventh most interesting man in the world.
I saw that, yes. Which I guess counts for something, right, John?
All it means is that on any given day, there's only six people having a better day than I am.
Hey, John, Bob Bupke here, and I'm going to do something I normally don't do with my guests, but I'm going to ask you an unfair question. I'm dying to get your reaction. You and I have shared a drink together. I'm wondering if you can remember where and when we did that.
Well, that is an unfair question because I don't have a context for it. Where would that be? Was it somewhere in Reno?
No.
In Vegas?
No. Surrounded by water.
Oh, boy, I give up on that one. I'll bet it's an island if it was surrounded by water.
You were at Lanai playing some golf. We had just finished Manili Bay. We came in to the clubhouse there. You were in attendance. I was with a fellow by the name of Alex Maselli, who had just did something remarkable, at least in his mind, out on the golf course. He was playing the 13th hole, put it in the bunker, took about 20 whacks, couldn't get it out. I told him, pick it up, I'm going to give you an X. He plays the 14th hole, which is a long par 3. He knocks a 3-iron in the cup, but it doesn't stop there. He gets to the hole and picks the ball out of the cup, John, and starts racing back to the tee, screaming at the top of his lungs, I just made a hole in one. I just made a hole in one. We had to corral him, and then he played the next hole, and it was over in water. He put several balls in the water. I said, pick up, I'll give you an X. And then he earned the nickname X1X. Then we flash forward in the clubhouse, and he's dying to buy anybody a drink. I see you at the bar, and I go, Alex, you can buy Mr. Peterman a drink. He said, what? I said, yep, there he is. And you celebrated Alex Maselli's all-in-one while we're at the island of Lanai, a very nice place.
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite places in the country to play golf.
That was a lot of fun, a lot of fun. And you're looking forward to your 27th appearance in the American Century Championship. How much fun is it to play in that event? I mean, when we watch it on television, carried on NBC and Peacock, it looks like a blast.
Well, I'll tell you, for any of the celebrity golfers, it's the greatest week in golf. You wait for your invitation to come to the mail every year, and when it comes, you hop right back on and the computer and go through the registration because you're so excited. It's a wonderful event. It was a wonderful concept for an event back when we started. I believe it was in 1991, if I believe correctly. I think that's
right.
It's been an extraordinary event, not only from the standpoint of watching the actual production grow, but also watching the quality of golf grow. That first year that we did the tournament, Mark Rippon finished the final day by shooting a 75, and I think everybody thought that he walked on water. But because sure enough, now we have today. I mean, we're in a Stableford scoring system, so it's a little bit different. But we essentially have guys shooting 65, 66, 67 out there with amazing repetition. It's been fascinating to watch the quality of golf grow.
John O'Hurley's a very special guest on Musings on Golf. Is there one memory out of the numerous years that you played in at that event that kind of sticks out a little bit?
I've always had a little bit of trouble on the par three up there, which is number seven. It's not a long par three, but it just seems to get my goat every year. Well, it was one of the first, or maybe the second year of the tournament. I got up there and it hit a flaming whoopsie right into the woods. I mean, straight into the woods. And all you hear was this knock. That's all you heard. And it sounded like a giant woodpecker hit the tree, shoots back out on the green, and stops about 3 inches away. I almost had an X1X.
You hit your tree wood very well.
That's not too far from the truth.
How did you get started in the game, John?
Well, my dad, God rest his soul, that was his sport. And for me as a youngster, it was a way to spend 4 hours with my dad. And as time went on and I developed the game and started to play better and better, it became a way for him to spend 4 hours with me. So he sadly passed away several years ago, just as the pandemic was starting. But golf was the sport that we all played together. I have two twin brothers, and that's my group.
Hey, it's such a pleasure to be joined by the great John O'Hurley here on Musings on Golf as we get closer to the start of the American Century Championship. Hey, John, I've read and heard you talk about the role of Jay Peterman almost coming naturally to you based on a boss that you had a number of years before. Can you talk a little bit about not only how you landed that role, but your ongoing involvement with the real Jay Peterman Company even to today?
It is kind of a funny story. Marshall McLuhan once said that eventually the message and the medium will become indistinguishable. And I am kind of the living example of that. I liked the role so much, I bought the company. Yeah. But to take you back, it was a very strange story. I had a show on ABC. It was a sitcom called A Whole New Ball Game. And it went along, had mild ratings. It wasn't a knockout hit, but it was a very funny show. But sure enough, ABC called in April and said, "Don't bother coming to work today. We pulled the plug on the show." And that's about as simply as they do it. So I went out to dinner that night, crying in my beer, trying to take the cancellation as personally as I possibly could. And during that time, I was out with my manager, and Larry David's office called while we were there at dinner. And he said, we have this role. It's a guest star role tomorrow on Seinfeld. And, we think John could kind of knock it out of the park. Is he interested? So I looked at my manager and quietly told him, "No, tell him no, I'm not interested." It's still licking the wounds over the cancellation of my own show. And so we left it at that. And I wake up the next morning and my manager calls me and he says, "I never called them and told them, no, they're waiting for you. The read through of the new script is at 10:30. And I said, "I said, you son of a bitch." So I dragged myself out of bed and went over there, and they handed me, Seinfeld was the most disorganized show on television. They hadn't even finished writing the script for the read through. So we were reading kind of half a prepared script, but they gave me a copy of the Jay Peterman catalog. And they said, "Well, what we want is we want it to sound the way the catalog is written." And if you read the catalog, it's one of the most unusual pieces of literature, commercial or otherwise, that you'll ever read. It looks like a Hemingway novel, trying to sell an Oxford button down. And, so I read it, and as I was reading it, it sounded a little bit like a 40s radio drama combined with a bit of a bad Charles Kuralt. And so that was kind of the origin of the character, the way that he, had this kind of, he kind of pontificated in a poetic type of way, with a cadence and a rhythm that was his own. And that's how the character grew. And the writers enjoyed it so much because it gave them a chance to kind of step away from the line by line and start to write in long form. Peterman always had a monologue that he would do on every show, and it was usually the funniest thing. It was just wonderful writing, and so it was wonderful to watch the character grow as the writers kind of latched onto him.
Actual involvement with the company, John.
Well, oddly enough, when the show ended back in '98, about 2 years later, the real Jay Peterman, John Peterman, who was the head of that brought the company up from its mild beginnings back in the 80s, he went belly up. He had some troubles financially. And even though the success of Seinfeld brought him somewhere near $750 million worth of free publicity. The sales department had kind of put a circle around that number. And so anyway, he went belly up, and another company bought him, and they went belly up. And so about 2 years later, I get a phone call from John, and I'm in New York, and he says, I'm putting the company back together again. Would you like to do it together under our parallel strengths? And I said, well, that would be fun. So I wrote him a really large check. And I went onto the board of the J. Peterman Company and was there for many, many years, 20 years perhaps, until I kind of bought my way out of the company. I haven't been active in the company in several years, but... But it's really been it was quite a ride, and I had a great time.
You had an unusual experience also with Dancing with the Stars. It seems like one minute you lost, next minute you won. Fill us in on that, John.
Well, this was the first year of Dancing with the Stars. It had just come over from England as a show that was entitled Strictly Come Dancing. And it was a huge hit over there. And what it was a show about competitive celebrity ballroom dancing. And I was the first one they asked. And I didn't realize that until ABC had taken me out to dinner one afternoon and pitched the show to me. And I said, well, it looks beautiful. It's going to be a big hit. I'll be glad to host it. And they said, no, we want you to do it. So I said, no. I said, I'll host it. And I said, no, I said, that's what I would do. I would host the show like this. They said, no, we want you to do it. Well, I've always believed that in my imagination is the answer to everything. If I can see a picture of myself succeeding in a venture, then I not only say yes to it, but I also feel as though I have to do it, because it wouldn't be there in my imagination if I wasn't honor bound to it. So I said, all right, I'll do it. Who else have you got? They said, you're the first one we've asked. But they said, now that we have you, we know we can get Evander Holyfield. And I said, what? So then it occurred to me, and I joke about this when I say that it occurred to me that ABC was going to use this midsummer replacement series to give America what they'd been looking for more than 15 years, and that was the Evander Holyfield, John O'Hurley matchup, together finally on the level playing field of ballroom dancing. For those of you who don't remember, I took him out in the third round with my foxtrot.
Too good.
But it was a very interesting run there. I consider it God's practical joke, putting me on a dance floor. But I learned quick, and I wasn't too bad at it. But I'm very competitive. And so, you know, I worked real hard, and it was 7 hours, 7 days a week. And I would wring three T-shirts out every day and from you know, rehearsing. And I took it seriously, and we did really well. And we were supposed to win it, but there were some, ABC set some rather strange rules in the voting for it. And so consequently, another actress on the show who was on General Hospital at the time ended up winning, even though she fell three times in her final dance. They were kind of honor bound to do it because she had all of the online voting because of her fan club. So anyway, it turned out to be a real fiasco. And they had like 45,000 complaints or something. And I said, it's too bad because they ruined what was going to be a great hit. Well, sure enough, a couple of months later, when they're doing the upfronts on the network television, they announced that they're going to do a dance-off because they had so many complaints about the voting. So they were going to do a dance-off between her and I. And so we did it. It was a two-hour special on a Monday night in October, I think it was. And sure enough, I ended up winning. So all was always right with America again. And it was fun. It was a great series, and I enjoyed it. And it was, it's still blessed with permanence some, 25 plus years ago. It's been 20 years ago. It's really amazing.
Well, we're proud to have John O'Hurley as our guest here on Musings on Golf. And John, not only talented with your dancing ability, but you're quite an accomplished piano player and also a highly acclaimed vocalist. How does one guy have so much talent?
Well, it's tough. It's tough to hit a moving target. I did teach myself to play the piano after I broke my finger on, and wasn't able to play the guitar anymore. So I just moved it over to another instrument, and I've recorded a couple of albums that have done very well on Billboard, that are all my kind of piano compositions, along accompanied by electronic cello. So it's kind of very, very soothing, very music that would replicate Yanni or someone like that. But I love that style of music. And then I also wrote a one-man musical for myself. And, of course, I have a long extended Broadway career from the musical Chicago and the Monty Python Spamalot. I did 2,000 performances of each of those shows. So I have a long extended vocal career. But I wrote a one-man musical, and it's called A Man with Standards. And it's basically taking the standards, the songs of the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. And I tell the stories, the interesting stories of my life growing up with the music of that period of time. And it's a lot of fun. It's done very well. It's been nominated for Best Show twice. And I continue to do it. I'll be actually leaving to go overseas and do a big run of the concert tour over there. And I enjoy it. I just have a great time. It's music, laughter, and only one tear.
Hey, John, wondering, were your parents musically inclined? Was music a part of you growing up?
Not at all, except my mother was a hummer. She hummed everything. She never sang a single note, but she hummed everything. And so she was always humming, you know, these great Moon River, Born Free, Gone with the Wind, Zorba the Greek, all of these wonderful tunes. She was always humming. So I always had, I grew up around melody in my life. And so for me to assume music and lyrics together was a very easy transition for me. But I knew at the age of three what I was going to do. So it wasn't, I was just trying to connect the dots.
Wow. Wow. You've connected a lot of dots through what you've done for many Thanksgivings now, with the National Dog Show presented by Purina, and brought a lot of happiness into our homes, John. I'm an NFL guy, and typically when that Macy's parade ends, I go to, you know, whether it's Fox or CBS is showing the 12 o'clock game, but I more and more go to watch you and what has to be just so much fun. I know you have some dogs, you and your wife own dogs yourselves, but yep. 22 yep. consecutive years coming up as the host of that. How'd you land that gig? And what's it meant? I know you're an ambassador of the Puppy Food Bank. That means a lot to you. The connecting of all the dots through that show is really special, John.
It is. And the whole world of dogs has been special to me. I've always been around a dog all my life. Even when I was 4 years old and in Natick, Massachusetts, I had a little dachshund named Taffy who would follow me everywhere. In fact, I tell the story of Taffy following me around my swamp at the end of the road there, which was kind of my secret hiding place. And along with that, the story that I tell, I sing the song, the accompanying song, Moon River, which is a nice accompaniment to it. But that's kind of what the show feels like. But I've always had a strong affiliation with dogs. So one day, I get a call, and apparently John Miller, who's the head of NBC Sports, had taken home Best in Show, this quirky little movie of Christopher Guest and Michael McKean. He watched it a couple of times over the weekend and just laughed out loud, walks into the morning meeting at NBC Sports and says, I know what we're going to do with that 2-hour slice between the Macy's parade and football. We're going to do a dog show. Well, they about laughed John out of the office. And by the end of the afternoon, had negotiated with the Kennel Club of Philadelphia, had struck up an arrangement for the National Dog Show. He called Purina. They came on as the presenting sponsor. And that following morning, on Tuesday morning, he called me in L.A. And I picked up the phone and I said, hello. And he said, woof, woof. That's how it all started. And You know, that first year that we did a dog show, we had 19 million people watching. It was an absolute overnight ratings success, probably one of the great pieces of television programming ever done. And to this day, our ratings continue to grow. We grew about 10% last year. So I think we're somewhere between 20 and 30 million people that watch every year. And of course, they repeat. So who really knows what the number is? But it's become a wonderful family tradition on the great family day of the year. And I'm just kind of honored. And I kind of pinch myself to think of all the years that we've been doing it. And we don't have to do much. We just get out of the way of the dogs. They present all the entertainment and round off all the edges in our life.
John, what is it about dogs? I've had dogs most of my life. What is it? What is it that strikes to the heart, that's so much of the soul of who we are as humans? What is it?
Well, they give us 100% of their care and their focus. Dogs live in the present moment. They don't know what the future is. They don't know what the past is. They only know what it's like to be right there with you. And it's kind of a very spiritual way to live. And I think that's what people love about their dogs. It just changes the environment when they're around. I've written 3 books on the subject and just a great time with the whole process of, and also it's the last remaining bench show in America, which means all of the dogs, the owners, the handlers have to remain behind the scenes. So it's a wonderful family event. We get an audience of between 15 and 20,000 there in the arena outside of King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, right before Thanksgiving. We shoot it kind of the week before.
Yeah.
Let you on the inside.
Yes, sir.
Unless you think it's real.
but it comes across as if it could have been that day. Well, it is
live,
right?
It's live to tape, sure. But it's a wonderful, wonderful show for the families to walk up and down the aisles. 2,000 of the best dogs in the country, every one of them a breed winner. 200 plus breeds of dogs that are there. It's really a magical moment. You know, when you're around a dog, you have a tendency to smile. So you can imagine what it's like when 15 or 20,000 people are all smiling in one room.
John, what's the Puppy Food Bank and what's your involvement as their ambassador?
Well, I stay very close to the world of dogs, not only purebred, but rescue dogs too. We have 2 rescues here at home. Big problem during the pandemic. Everybody was locked down. Everybody was alone, no one knew what to do or how long it was going to last. And for companionship, a lot of people found solace by going to the animal shelters and adopting a dog or a cat. And that went fine and until the end of the pandemic and people had to go back to work. Well, guess what happens? They can no longer tend to the animal or they can't afford to upkeep because, as you remember, prices went prices of everything have gone through the roof. So they were returning dogs and cats in record numbers to shelters all across the country. And this has been a pandemic aftermath, and it's a huge problem. Shelters that could handle only 200 dogs or cats now had 650 that they had to deal with. And these are no-kill shelters, so they're not going down. And so they've got to feed them. Every one of those mouths has to be fed. Well, a friend of mine, Bob Wills in San Antonio, we came up with an idea of getting the funds together to provide all of the food for all of the shelters in the country. And it seems like we started off in Texas as kind of a beta test to see how it would go. And it just went through the roof. People, you know, just throwing money at us every which way but loose. And it's wonderful that we've been able to help so many shelters. We decided that we were going to expand it nationally. So it's now puppyfoodbank.org. And we're asking for donations of $15 a month. And we have 15,000 shelters in this country that we've got to do. But I think it's a wonderful goal. And I think we'll get there.
Well, you're certainly to be congratulated on that. One other thing from me, John, before we let you go, and we certainly appreciate your time. understand you're quite a Red Sox fan.
Oh, you talk about my boys. Yes, Red Sox, Celtics, anything from Boston. When I lived there, I was born in Maine and grew up my whole life in and around New England. So the sports, all the Boston sports teams are very close to me. Yes, I'm a Red Sox fan and was lucky enough to see Ted Williams play his last 2 years there. Went there with my dad, and every year we always had our Fenway trip. And it was the memories of him are all over that place. And I even bought him a stone there that is now in the pavement there for commemorating him. I'm a big Red Sox fan and go Celtics too.
Let me give you a little Red Sox story. I pitched against Carl Yastrzemski in high school.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. He was a senior. I was a freshman. I was brought in relief. He was up. He hit one about 800 feet. We didn't have fences in those days, so my center fielder caught it. I went to Cooperstown the day he got inducted, and I said, Carl, I don't understand how you're getting in the Hall of Fame. You couldn't even get a hit against me. Now he laughed like crazy.
That's a wonderful story. Oh, wonderful story. Yes, was the greatest.
You hear parents all the time saying, my son's going to be this, or my daughter's going to be that. And most times, almost exclusively, it never works out. When Carl was 4 years old, his father would tell anybody that would listen, my son is going to be a Major League Baseball player. His dad was a very good player. But he worked with Carl starting at age four, and every day threw him balls, and made him hit, made him feel, and lo and behold, Carl Sr. had the vision that came through.
Well, he passed it on to his son as well, and it's a shame the Red Sox couldn't continue the tradition of having a Yastrzemski on the team, but I guess he's off on the other coast there. I have so many great stories of the Boston Red Sox. I'm very close to the team, and actually had the dubious honor of singing at Tim Wakefield's this past year. Tim was a very, very dear friend of mine, as many of the Red Sox are. But he was a great man, and there wasn't a single soul in Boston who didn't think he was one of the great athletes that ever passed through the gates of Fenway Park.
Yeah, that knuckleball that so many players, so many other opponents couldn't hit it.
It mystified everybody, including him.
Yeah. But he was a terrific guy. John, final question, as you prepare for the American Century Championship, and this is something we ask all of our guests, if you could kind of round out a dream foursome, if you will, three others who, whether they're living or deceased, who would they be, and where would you play that magical round of golf?
Oh, well, I'm torn between Augusta and Pebble Beach. Pebble Beach has so many wonderful memories for me. It's where I got engaged, which was on the seventh hole. I had the ring inside the hole. I had a 5-carat.
Tell more about that, please, John. Elaborate, please.
It was, I took my wife up. I took her up to Pebble for my birthday. And I wanted to remember, because I was going to engage myself to her. And she didn't know that. Our plane went up to Pebble Beach, and I had the 5-carat diamond ring put in the hole waiting. And we went out at 5:30 at night, and I convinced her that we were going to play a $100 skins game. Well, it didn't really occur to her. You can't just do that on Pebble Beach, go out and play.
It worked that way.
We went out there. And I figured what I was going to do, I had this all scripted. I had a photographer hidden in the bushes to capture every moment of this. It was a Chamber of Commerce day with the wind and the sunset, actually the wind blowing in, and the waves were gorgeous. It was a spectacular day. So I decided I was going to take an extra club and hit it into the back trap. My wife, who is a 4 handicap, and put that ball anywhere she wants to. And I said, well, she's going to stick it right by the hole. And the wind came up and I hit it 4 feet from the hole. She hits it into the back trap. Oh. Well, now she's mad. So she sculls it across the green because she could barely get a club on it. And so she's in the trap in the front. She gets out of that, puts that about 8 feet away from the pin. I'm now putting for birdie. She's putting for bogey. And I dropped to my knees and I said, sweetie, just pull the pin and I'll put you out of your misery. She says, oh, you've won your $100. Leave me alone. And she pushes me down on the ground. So now I'm lying flat on my back on the green. The photographer is way off in the bushes. He can't hear or see what, he doesn't really understand what's going on. So he stopped taking pictures because he thought she said no. So I am lying on my back on the seventh hole green there, looking straight up, because she picked up, she took the pin out and she threw the box over her shoulder. She never even looked. She wasn't even curious enough to look. She says, a box here. And I go, yeah. She threw it over her shoulder, never even looked. So I'm lying on the ground there. I said, honey, the box was for you. She burst out into tears. At that moment, she realized that there was something in it. And she went and found it. And it was the ring and our engagement. But it went unphotographed because he thought she said no.
What a great story. That is classic.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Didn't end up the way I thought, but I took that $100. You bet.
Yes, sir, you did. Yes, sir. All right, so would your wife be one of the three that you'd play that magical round of golf with?
Absolutely. You know, I would take her dad, he's a wonderful golfer. He's in his late 70s now, and he just shot a 61 about 2 days ago. Yeah, wow. He's quite a golfer. I would take her, and I would have my dad do it once around for me. Yep, so that would be the four, and we'd go back to either to Pebble or to Augusta. We've been to both, obviously from Pebble, but we took her dad on his 70th birthday to Augusta to play. So that was kind of fun for him.
John, just as we close, obviously golf has lots of meanings in so many ways to lots of people. What does the game at large mean to you?
Well, it's the act of the infinite possibility. when you stand on the tee, anything can happen, but ultimately you're responsible for it. So there's no, you can't say that, oh, the team didn't, or it's all you. And I love the idea of things that are individual responsibility. So that's kind of what it means to me. And I can be as good as I choose to be. Yes, luck has a lot to do with it, but more often and moreover, it's about how much I put into it. And I haven't been putting too much into it lately, I'll tell you. Let me put it this way. If double bogey were a fabric, I would be draped in it.
Well, we wish you the very best of luck at the American Century Championship. Again, July 12th through 14th on NBC Sports Golf Channel at Peacock. Bob, what a treat to have had Mr. Hurley.
Yeah, thank you, John. And next time I'm at Lanai, I'll be looking for you next clubhouse.
All right, my friend. Great to talk to you today.
William and Harry, a luxury lifestyle on and off the golf course. Please visit williamandharry.com to place your order, but be sure to add our special promo code. That's 10 off MOG for a nice 10% discount. That's 10 off MOG.
Well, we thank our friend John O'Hurley very much for joining us here on Musings on Golf. Loved all the stories. Next week, Super Bowl champion Joe Theismann, who's also participating in the American Century Championship, will be joining us. And in 2 weeks, Xander Schauffele, head of the Open Championship, wishing all of you a very happy 4th of July. Kelly Elbin for Bob Bupka signing off on Musings on Golf.